This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I am here. I'm the program manager at the Optimizing Aging Center, which is based in the Division of Geriatrics at UCSF. And I am delighted to be here tonight to introduce our experts on medication management. Tonight we have Dr. John Newman, who is a lab researcher in the biology of aging, and he practices medicine at the San Francisco VA Medical Center, where he specializes in the care of hospitalized older adults. We also have with us tonight Dr. Kirby Lee, who is a clinical pharmacist who researches medication management and drug therapy for patients with chronic disease. His practice focuses on older adults with cognitive impairment, memory, and behavior change, and he serves in the complex care support team at the UCSF Medical Center. Welcome and thank you for being here.
Well, thanks, everybody. I'm glad you could all make it today. Thank you for putting game one of the World Series on tape delay for us so we can talk about medications in older adults. Kirby and I, unfortunately, both have no financial interest to declare. I think we're both working hard on that. One day that will change. So we're going to talk about medications and you. And here's a quick summary of the things we'll be talking about tonight. Medications save lives. We're going to talk about this thing called polypharmacy, when more can become less, when too much of a good thing can start to harm you. And then we'll lay out some principles for safely using medications in older adults. And some specific tips for what you can do yourself and with your doctor to get the most good out of your medicines and avoiding some of the harms. And just to lay out the standard caveat, we're going to talk about general principles for how to approach medicines and how to approach your medical care, but we can't answer specific medical advice for you in particular about your medicines. But we're happy to talk about general principles of how to approach things. So, as Alicia said, I'm a geriatrician at UCSF and the San Francisco VA Medical Center. Kirby is a pharmacist. We've worked together for a while now, actually, in helping to manage the care of complex older adults. Some of my best friends are pharmacists, both inside and outside the hospital. And as you'll see, pharmacists and geriatricians work together very closely to give the best possible care to our older patients. First, though, we're going to start with FDR. So why in the world are we starting a lecture about medications and polypharmacy with Franklin Delano Roosevelt? Hang with me for a second. I'll get to that. It'll make sense, I promise. So FDR, of course, was president of the United States during the Great Depression and World War II. He didn't survive the presidency, though. He died in April of 1945, just before the end of World War II, from a massive stroke. He was only 63. He always looks a lot older in pictures and in statues, but he was only 63 when he died. If FDR had had access to modern medications, even medications that were available in the 60s and 70s, he almost certainly would have survived to see the end of World War II. My best guess is he probably would have survived to see JFK be sworn in as president 15 years later. So FDR died of a stroke. He died of a hemorrhagic stroke. He bled into his brain. Many of these strokes, most of them, are caused by high blood pressure. When FDR had his stroke that day, his blood pressure was 300 over 195. Raise your hand if you even knew blood pressures could get that high. I've never seen that in my life, and I hope to never see that in my life. These are FDR's blood pressures over the last year or so of his life, 1944, 1945. For the entire last year of his life, his blood pressures were more than 200 over 100. You know, these days, if he had come into to see any clinic anywhere in the country with a blood pressure like that, he'd be sent straight to the emergency room, because this is an emergency. And he lived the last year of his life like that, and then, not unexpectedly, had a hemorrhagic stroke and died. If his blood pressure had been under better control with the medicines that we have available now, he would have lived probably much longer. So We're going to spend most of the next hour, hour and a half, talking about how medicines can hurt you and giving you tips and skills for how to avoid the harm from medicines and too many medicines. But I think it's really important to make the point up front. Medicines help you. Medicines save lives in a very tangible way. Treating blood pressure saves lives today. We're still learning from large randomized trials exactly how much to lower people's blood pressure to get the most benefit, the most bang for our buck in avoiding harm. And I'll show you a little bit of data from two very recent large randomized trials just to drive home the point that even in an era of modern medicine, I mean, sure, back in the 30s or 40s, if FDR had blood pressure medicines, he would live longer. But even today, in the context of otherwise modern medicine, treating blood pressure to just the right amount can still save lives. So this is data from a large randomized trial that miraculously, for large randomized trials, was done exclusively in older adults over 85 years old. And these are the 4 years of the study and the rate of people dying in the study. And the difference between these two lines are the number of lives that were saved by being in the group that lowered the blood pressure more. So all in all, lowering blood pressure gently, even in people over 85 years old, reduced the risk of dying by 20%. That's pretty good. I'll take that pill. We're still learning, though, just how low is best. So you may have heard of another large trial that was in the news last year called SPRINT that took the next step. So HIVET lowered blood pressure a little bit in older adults. SPRINT lowered it a little bit more to see if there would still be even more benefit from that. And again, here's the risk of dying over the course of the study from people with the now standard treatment inspired by HIVET and the new lower goal. And the difference between these two lines are the lives that were saved by the lower blood pressures from more and more intensive blood pressure medications. So medications save lives. A very specific, easy example by lowering blood pressure and preventing heart attacks and strokes. And I should say, we're happy to take questions, and I hope you have lots of questions. At the end of each 5 or 10 minute section, we'll ask for your questions about that section. So if you have a question, hang on to it for just a minute. And finally, medications don't just save lives, but they actually help us live better, healthier, happier lives. So lowering blood pressure in these big studies doesn't just prevent people from dying, but it prevents other diseases that can really impact their quality of life. So an example of that is heart failure. So in this big HIVET study, they found that lowering blood pressure caused fewer strokes and less heart failure. And here's the numbers for heart failure. So again, the difference between these lines are people who got heart failure in the original standard of care group versus the many fewer people who got heart failure with lowering their blood pressure more with medicines. So it should go without saying, of course, but medicines save lives. The trick is getting most of the good that can come from medicines and avoiding as much as possible of the harms that medicines can cause too. And that's what we're going to talk about for the rest of the hour. And before I move on to the next section, does anyone have questions about that so far? Go ahead. Yeah, great question. So the question was, in the graphs I just showed you, they compared standard treatment or placebo group to active treatment or the intervention. What does that actually mean in terms of numbers? Well, HIVET, I'll tell you real quickly. So HIVET took people whose blood pressure was over 160 over 90. The first one tested whether lowering blood pressure at all in older adults was beneficial. They lowered blood pressure to a goal of 140 over 90. So they tried to get people to 140 over 90. They actually got people to more like 150 over 90. And that worked. That helped. SPRINT took the next step. So instead of aiming for 140 over 90, they aimed for 130 over 80. And they actually mostly got there. So SPRINT said that for most older adults, a blood pressure of 130 over 80 is a pretty good goal to shoot for. Now, the big national organizations that make recommendations haven't quite digested this all yet, so this isn't yet reflected in recommendations from big groups, but it will be soon. Great question. Other questions about this so far? The graph on heart failure here comes from that very first trial. So the placebo group, their blood pressures were in the 160 over 90-ish range, whereas in the treatment group, they were just a little bit lower, 140 to 150 over 80 to 90. So is this mostly congestive heart failure? Yes. Yeah, this is a form of heart failure that's very much related to untreated high blood pressure. FDR had that too. So the the question was, these are higher than the numbers in these trials that they aimed for are higher than what we often hear of as normal, which is 120 over 80. These trials were specifically looking at older adults, people over 65, people over 85, because there used to be a lot of debate about maybe we shouldn't lower blood pressure at all in older adults. Maybe they shouldn't be normal. But we're learning now that, yes, we should be lowering blood pressure in older adults, and we're still trying to figure out just how low is good before we get to too much is bad. And I have some information I'll show you about the too much is bad part in just a moment. I'll turn things over to Kirby.
Thanks, John. So you've learned a lot about how medicines can be very helpful. Okay. Now, there's also a flip side. Medicines can also be harmful. And this is really most of the talk. The remaining of the talk is about emphasizing the safety and the appropriate use of medications, because I have to say, medication mishaps, misadventures, problems, adverse drug events are very, very common in older adults. Okay? And in fact, it's not just medications, but too much of anything can cause harm. So, for example, if you were to drink too much water, that can actually be harmful. We make that simple, showing that you can drown in it, but it actually can lead to low sodium in your body and cause seizures, if that's the more technical term. And while we're focusing on medications, we also want you to extrapolate this to dietary supplements, vitamins, herbals. Lots of people think that those are natural remedies, that they don't have side effects or pharmacologic effects. That's actually not true. They can interact with drugs. They can be toxic. It can have lots of side effects. There are some herbs and dietary supplements that can be very helpful, and there are those that can be very unsafe. So we want to talk about a concept called polypharmacy. You're going to hear this a lot. And what this means is that someone is taking lots of medications. And if you look at this figure here, there's not just medications, but there's supplements, there's vitamins, there's lots of other things that they might be taking. And why it's a problem is because we want to make sure that you have the right balance of medications. You don't want to be taking too many medications that are not necessary, that may not be causing any benefits but more harms, that might be duplicate therapy. And you also want to make sure you're not missing any medications that can be very, very helpful, that can save lives. Problems that are caused by polypharmacy, so if you're taking lots of different medications, you can sometimes be taking a medication that is doing the same thing as another medication. You're not aware of it. And one of the challenges there is that the medication names can be very different, but their effects can be the same. And I'll give you some examples of how to identify duplicate medications. You might be taking medications for a side effect that was really caused by another drug. And so really you need to stop that drug rather than take another drug to treat a side effect. That's called a prescribing cascade, and we'll go over an example of that in more detail. The more medications you take, the more risk you have for interactions. The more difficult it is to take them all. They're sheer just numbers of medications or remembering to take them all. Difficulty swallowing them. Difficulty administering them. Difficulty in paying for them. And then just taking so many medications where you really don't actually need a medication. There's lots of other types of interventions or treatments that could be physical therapy, that could be diet, it could be exercise or movement. So there's lots of other things to consider, not necessarily a drug that has to be used each time. So some examples of duplicate therapy. These are all cases where you should only be on one of these types of drugs from this class, typically. But if you notice, so for cholesterol, many people have high cholesterol who are older adults, and so they might take a medication called a statin. And how do we know that these are statins? Because if you look at their name, you'll see atorvastatin, lovastatin, pravastatin. So you should only be taking one of these. You don't need two drugs that are statins. Same thing with proton pump inhibitors. These help people who have GERD or stomach problems or heartburn. So you'll see the common name is azole, so omeprazole, esomeprazole, lansoprazole, pantoprazole. Again, there should only be one of these medications. These medications, they're called benzodiazepines. These are a little bit more challenging because they're actually quite unsafe in older adults. But if you look at the common name, it's Azolam, Azapam. Okay? And then antidepressants, they're a little bit unique because their names don't always rhyme. You have fluoxetine, paroxetine, sertraline, but then you have some that sound differently, like citalopram or escitalopram. But you would not want to be on two of these types of medications. So this is a way to figure out if you're taking medications that might be in the same class, which you really should only be on one of. So how is it that people, particularly older adults in general, have polypharmacy? Why are they taking lots of medications? Well, because we know that medications can save lives. And we also know that as we age, we develop more chronic conditions. Those conditions, unfortunately, we don't have a cure for yet, so we have to take medications to manage those conditions. But as we age, we don't just have one medical condition, but we have multiple. So you might have high blood pressure. You might have diabetes. You might have arthritis. You might have an enlarged prostate. You might have had breast cancer. So it goes on and on and on, and so you start to develop more medications. And oftentimes, we might need two or three medications to manage those conditions. So now you have to take more complicated drug therapies. And then what gets even more challenging is that you're often seeing different doctors who prescribe these medications. So it could be an endocrinologist for your diabetes, a rheumatologist for your arthritis, a urologist for any urinary symptoms, a cardiologist for your blood pressure. And the challenging thing about our system is that not all of the providers are in good communication with the others. So they often don't know what else is being prescribed. So they're not always being able to check on drug interactions or just the appropriateness of the medication they are prescribing you. You also might go to different pharmacies. Maybe you go to the pharmacies that's close to you on the corner. Maybe you get your medications from a mail order. Some of the people were having very, very challenging with issues with cost in Canada. So folks Maine, the state of Maine, were going across to Canada to get their medications for cheaper. So if you're going to multiple pharmacies, they also don't know what they're dispensing to you, and there can also be miscommunication in which medications you're getting. And finally, as we mentioned earlier, sometimes you develop an adverse reaction or a side effect to a medication. They think that's a new medical condition, so then they prescribe another medication when instead they should have stopped that initial medication. So lots of reasons why you can be put on too many medications. And this is just an example. If someone has diabetes, we usually have to control their blood pressure more closely and their cholesterol. So they might be on two diabetes medications, two blood pressure medications, something for their cholesterol, and something to prevent a heart attack or a stroke. So that right there alone is two, four, five, six medications. And then we often have to, sometimes the medications stop working, so we have to switch them. And sometimes we also have to make sure that the doses are right. As a general rule of thumb for older adults, medications should be prescribed to you at low doses to make sure that they're safe and they don't cause adverse effects. And then we slowly increase them to get to the right benefit. Multiple prescribers, again, I want to emphasize that oftentimes the communication between them is challenging. It's not that they don't want to talk, but they're very busy. Sometimes our medical records don't communicate well between other systems, and so this poor communication can lead to misunderstandings and medication misadventures. It's also important to have all your doctors, review your medications with you. Not at each visit, but it should be something done at least annually so that they are aware of what's going on. They can make an informed decision and make sure that they're making the best decisions, prescribing decisions on your behalf. That way they can pull off medications that don't have an indication, pull off medications that are doing the same thing or duplicates, screen for drug interactions, and make sure they get the doses right for you. In general, if you can have a geriatrician and a primary care provider who oversees what all the other specialists are doing, that would be great. But we realize that sometimes it's not always easy to find a primary care provider. Okay. And then how many medications on average do you think older adults take? So we have empirical evidence that suggests that Nearly 30% of older adults living in the community, so those who are relatively healthy still, take five or more medications. The patients that I see, on average, they're taking 15 or 20 medications, but they're much more complex. But still, a third of folks are taking five or more medications. That's a lot. Okay, and that already now predisposes you at risk for drug interactions and possibly inappropriate therapy. Now, folks who live in nursing homes, they're taking nine or more medications, so a lot more. But they usually have more medical conditions and are sicker. And the key take-home message is that the more medications you take increases your risk for inappropriate medications and unnecessary medications. So if you're taking five or more medications, it would be good to have your medications reviewed by your doctors and a pharmacist. And how can we reduce polypharmacy and excessive medications? You don't always need to use a medication to manage conditions. So oftentimes, things like sleep, things like pain, there's other alternatives besides using a medication. Making sure that the doses are correct and making sure that they're titrated or adjusted so that they're producing benefits and avoiding side effects. I mentioned earlier to periodically review all of your medications with your doctors. And that if you're going to take a new medication or be prescribed a new medication, make sure you really know what it's for, you know the benefits and the risks, and someone has screened it for drug interactions being added to your existing medications. We're going to switch to John now. Do you have any questions?
Okay. Yeah, you said that benzodiazepines are unsafe in older adults. Why is that?
Yeah. So the benzodiazepines, we talk about those as being an unsafe drug. Oh, so the question is, why are benzodiazepines unsafe in older adults? Very good question. It's because we usually have safer alternatives than using these drugs. These drugs increase the risk of a fall greatly, and they can also increase your risk of confusion and memory problems and your ability to think clearly. And because we have safer alternatives to use, we like to avoid these medications in older adults. So very good question. The question is, it's been recommended and advocated by the Affordable Care Act and general principles. It's demanded. It is. So good health care requires good communication between providers. Our healthcare system has a number of challenges to be able to do that. Yes, part of it is the doctors are very busy. The whole system is very busy. The whole system is taxed. That's why we're giving you this lecture, because there are pitfalls in our system that we're trying to empower you to help fill these gaps. Our electronic medical records are very challenging. Even within our own healthcare system, they don't always communicate well. Now, if you're going to different providers at different institutions, that's even more challenging. Okay?
If you're sick, that is you.
Yes.
I think, not based on my own experience, because I speak well, that I had an old friend who was in a very good restaurant, and they avoided sleep stuff for their patients. And she told me the whole place ran on Tylenol PM. So what good is that doing? Because my belief is that too much Tylenol night after night isn't doing a lot of good either.
So you bring up another good point. So the question was, a colleague of hers was sleeping well in a nursing home and they were giving everyone Tylenol PM.
No. They weren't sleeping well.
They weren't sleeping well.
Their geriatrician was again giving them medications. So they all bought Tylenol PM.
Okay.
And took it every night.
Okay. So they weren't sleeping well. They weren't happy with the medications that they were given, so they went and sought out a different medication called Tylenol PM, which you can buy over the counter, and that's actually another drug that we don't like to use in older adults. The Tylenol is okay, it's the PM. Does anyone know what the PM stands for? It's a drug called diphenhydramine. The diphenhydramine helps you sleep. That is one of the worst drugs that an older adult can take. It can increase your risk of falls. It can increase your risk for confusion. It can lead to worsening memory. It causes constipation, dry mouth, blurred vision. It has a number of side effects. And all of you have handouts. We gave you a big packet of handouts. And there's a lot of information in there, but one of the key handouts explains which drugs older adults should avoid because their risks are greater than their benefits, and we have safer alternatives. I'll take one more question because we want to get through the talk.
Are regular vitamin pills like vitamin D and iron and I don't know, calcium, I mean, is that considered a medication or is that something separate from what you're talking about? Are vitamins also risky? I mean, or is that a different category?
No. I would lump everything I'm talking about to you today, these principles also apply to vitamins, supplements, herbals.
Okay.
So right now, our technical term of an older adult is 65 years and older.
Okay. Thanks. So since we're talking about older adults a lot, I'll give you my idea of what an older adult might be too. There's really not an age cutoff. There is some truth to that you're as old as you feel. So what is an older adult? An older adult tends to be someone who's older, okay, tends to be someone who has more chronic medical conditions, tends to be someone who's on more medications. It tends to be someone who needs help doing some of the day-to-day things that they used to do on their own, things like going to the pharmacy to get their medications or things like driving. And, you know, sort of the geriatrician's idea of how old are you depends on how much help you need with things. So if you need help taking a shower, if you need help brushing your teeth, you're older, even if you're the same age, than someone who does all those things by themselves. So that's sort of what we mean by this vague term of older adults. Just remember, there is no strict age cutoff, and I've met a lot of very young 80 and 90-year-olds, and I've met some very old 45 and 50-year-olds. But older adults. So let's catch up to where we were. So principles. Principles for safely using medications with older adults. So this is the conceptual part of the talk. I'm going to try to walk you through a handful of principles that you can then apply to your own situation or that of your family or loved ones and inform how you talk with your doctor about your medications and all the pills you take. So the first principle, and this is a pretty important one, is the principle of diminishing benefit and increasing harm. So having just spent a bunch of time talking about how medications are great, medications save lives, they keep you hale and hearty and healthy. So here's the part where sometimes they can start to do more harm than good. So as Kirby said, for many diseases, many conditions, there are lots of medicines you can take for them. Often you wind up on more than one medicine for a particular disease or condition. You take more than one diabetes medicine. You take more than one blood pressure medicine. That very first medicine you take for any particular disease or condition probably helps a lot. It probably gives you a huge benefit in helping to control the risks and the downsides of having that disease in the first place. The very first medicine is huge. Every additional medicine may still help a little more. Lowering your blood pressure a little more may still help, but not as much as that first medicine. So the first medicine helps a lot. The second medicine helps a little less, but it's still good. The third medicine maybe helps just a tiny bit. And the fourth medicine, maybe you're actually getting harmed by that medicine rather than helping, even if it seems like it's a good idea. So each extra medicine you take for any particular condition or disease adds a little bit less benefit than the one before. Does that make sense? So that's the idea of diminishing marginal benefit. So on the margin, each extra one may help, but not as much as the one before. On the other hand, each extra medicine increases the risk of harms more than the last one. So if you just take one medicine for, say, diabetes, sure, you might get a side effect to that medicine, but you're only exposed to the potential side effects of that one medicine. Let's say you take two medicines for diabetes. Well, now you're exposed to the side effects from both separately. You're also exposed to the problems that their interaction can cause. So with two medicines, there's more of a risk of harm than either one alone. with three medicines, with four medicines, with five medicines, that additional risk gets more and more. This is easiest to think about in terms of interactions between drugs. You know, of course, if you're only taking one medicine, it can't interact with anything, right? If you take two, there's only the interaction with each other. If you take three, they can all interact with each other. If you take four, they can all interact with each other, and now you have 16 possible interactions. You take five, it's 25. You take six, it's 36. And so the more and more medicines, the greater the increase in risk that each one brings. So increasing marginal risks. So that fifth or sixth medicine for a given condition may give you very little extra benefit, but may expose you to a much higher risk of harm. And we've talked a little already about what some of these harms are. The risks of falling, risks of confusion and memory loss, delirium, a sudden confusional state that's common in older adults who already have memory problems, risks of being hospitalized for side effects, interactions between medicines, as I alluded to, and of course side effects. And it gets harder and harder to take all the pills the right way the more that you have. I have a hard time sometimes even taking one pill every day without fail. If I had to take 20 medications, each one with multiple, or many of them with multiple doses at four or five times throughout the day, as some of the patients that Kirby and I see are supposed to do, I mean, forget it. I'm not trained well enough to do that. So the goal between you and your doctor is to stay in this Goldilocks zone, this happy place where the extra medicines you take are doing more good than harm, and not doing more harm than good. Stay in the happy zone. Okay, so on that thread, the Goldilocks principle. So this applies to almost everything involving the treatment of medical conditions in older adults. So as I showed with FDR and blood pressure, treating medical conditions in older adults can help them a lot. Because older adults are more likely to have diseases, they're more likely to have more serious diseases, for a variety of reasons, that some of which we'll talk about, they're more likely to experience the harms of having those diseases in a way that affects their life and can kill them. So treating diseases in older adults obviously helps a lot, even more than in younger people as a general rule. But older adults can also be harmed by overtreatment, much more than younger people. And at the extreme, the harms of medications can be just as dangerous as the disease you're trying to treat. So the Goldilocks principle. You want to treat, but not too much. So here it is as a graph. I like graphs. You've probably already gotten that impression. So here's Goldilocks. This graph shows the risk of something you want to avoid on the one axis. So, for example, dying. So risk of dying is higher here. It's much better here. On the other axis is the intensity of treatment, how many pills you're taking for that, how many different sorts of treatments. So very little treatments, lots of pills, lots of treatments. FDR was here. FDR had a blood pressure of 300. He was not getting treated enough, right? So lowering FDR's blood pressure would have lowered his risk of dying. However, if you keep adding more and more blood pressure pills and lower the blood pressure more and more and more, eventually you cross through this U-shaped just right area, and you get into the too much treatment part, where the treatments can actually harm you rather than helping you. In the case of blood pressure, it's a little ironic because the harms of treatment can be the same things you're trying to avoid in the first place, like strokes. So blood pressure that's too high causes strokes, causes heart attacks, causes heart failure. Blood pressure that's too low can also cause strokes, can cause falls, can cause other problems. So not too little treatment, not too much treatment. You really want to be just right. So the hard part is figuring out what just right really means for you and for a particular disease or condition. And in a lot of cases, we're still trying to nail down, even in the case of blood pressure, exactly what just right means. But here's an example of data from the real world showing the U-shaped curve for blood pressure. So these are the blood pressures of 650,000 older veterans. And this is their risk of dying. So at very high blood pressures, this scale doesn't even go up to 300. So FDR was off the scale. He was way up here. He had a very, very high risk of dying. On the other hand, if your blood pressure is very, very low, a systolic blood pressure of, say, 60, which will give your doctor a heart attack just as surely as a blood pressure of 300. If your systolic blood pressure is 60, your risk of dying is about as high. So you want to be somewhere in the middle. In the case of this data set, there's actually a pretty wide flat area here where the risk of dying is the lowest. But this is an example of U-shaped treatment effects in older adults. You want to treat the condition, but not too much. You want to be somewhere in the middle, just enough treatment. The next principle, everybody gets side effects. Old people, young people, everyone gets side effects. But older adults get them worse, and we'll tell you why. So before we move on to side effects, does anyone have questions about the Goldilocks principles? Go ahead.
Yeah, it occurs to me, as related just to that, but we're talking about an older adult, long-term use of certain drugs. Mm-hmm. And then what happens if they get sick? They're adding more drugs until that gets done. What are the impacts of that kind of syndrome?
Yeah, so the question is about, we're mostly talking about chronic diseases where you're taking medicines for a long time. But what about when you get sick?
We're avoiding getting sick, we're not sick.
Yeah, but what if you get sick and then you're taking more medicines for whatever you're sick with for the short term, and how does that affect things? Well, of course, if you're sick with an infection, for example, you certainly want to take antibiotics if it's appropriate to fix what's making you sick. One of the dangers, though, and we'll talk about this more in a couple of minutes, is sometimes those medications that get added on for a short time stay there, and they stay forever. They turn into zombie medications. And one of the things we'll talk about is how to identify those and make sure that when they're no longer helping you, they stop.
So one of the themes seems to be promoting good communication either between patient and prescribing physicians or among team of physicians. My question is, when an older adult, or anyone for that matter, is hospitalized, nowadays they're treated by a hospitalist who by definition is a stranger. My question is, there must be some studies. Are there studies comparing adverse events of hospitalized patients managed by hospitalists versus a known physician? Because it seems like a good solution for busy doctors, but really counterintuitive for simplifying communications, specifically prescribing medication.
That's a great question. So the question is about when you are sick and in the hospital. More and more these days, people in the hospital are taken care of by hospitalists who specialize in just doing that all the time, rather than how it used to be in the old days, often by their primary care doctor who would just come to the hospital and visit and take care of them. But how does that affect communication between providers? That's a great question, and this is actually a huge problem. So it's a problem on both ends with the communication. It's often hard, and I can say some of this firsthand as someone who's both worked as a primary care doctor and in the hospital as essentially a hospitalist. It's often difficult when someone is in the hospital for the people in the hospital to know what they really were supposed to be taking. And you need to try to get data from the person, from their family, from their medication cabinet, from their pill set, and from the primary care doctor. And sometimes it can be really hard to figure out what the primary care doctor meant for them to be on. And then on the other side, when they're leaving the hospital then, of course, things have sometimes changed. Sometimes the primary care doctor would have done things differently, may have not used that medication or used a different one when they leave the hospital. And sometimes it's hard for the primary care doctor to learn what happened in the hospital. These are all major challenges many large medical centers are trying to address by formalizing communication between primary care doctors, the hospital team, and then, again, the primary care doctor on the way out the door. But it is a huge problem, and especially when you're in the hospital, is a real moment of risk when mistakes can happen because that information is imperfectly kept and imperfectly communicated between the different care settings. And this is a whole area of study in medicine for improving the quality of care, for how to make those handoffs more informative and more seamless. My advice on a personal level is if you or a loved one should wind up in the hospital, one way or another, bring with you a list, which is the master list of what you or your loved one actually takes at home. Actually bring several copies of it give it to almost everyone you meet in the hospital, and make sure that when you leave the hospital, you have that same list with the changes marked on it, and bring that, get copies of that too, and bring that to your primary care doctor when you leave. Next.
I noticed you didn't mention diastolic blood pressure. What role does diastolic blood pressure, I think in the old days, they used to monitor the diastolic more than the systolic.
Sure. So the question is about what about diastolic blood pressure? I've mostly been talking about systolic, the top number, rather than diastolic, the bottom number. High diastolic pressures are just as dangerous as high systolic pressures, actually in some cases even more so. On the other hand, low diastolic pressures are just as dangerous, sometimes more so, as low systolic pressures. I mostly talk about systolic because older adults tend to more often get hypertension of the systolic number more than the diastolic number. When you treat your blood pressure with medications, both numbers tend to come down. So it's just a shorthand, but both numbers are important. Yeah.
You mentioned someone taking like blood pressure medicine or medicine for diabetes, and then they would go from one medicine to two medicines without getting significant increased benefit. Why does that happen? If you're taking one medicine, it works for a while, and then it starts to not have the same benefit, so the doctor adds a second one. What's the medicine?
Yeah, so the question is, how does this diminishing marginal benefit thing actually work? Why would it be that the third or fourth medicine wouldn't still help?
Why did they prescribe? Why did they keep prescribing additional medicines rather than saying, oh, well, this isn't having the benefit that it did, let's try something else? Why did they keep adding on?
Fantastic. So sorry, I misunderstood it first. So the question is, why do doctors do this in the first place? Which I can speak to a little. So why do you add a fourth or a fifth or a sixth medicine instead of trying to think of why aren't the first four working? Your doctor should be thinking, why aren't the first four working? Different people respond differently to different medications, and I think that's a great idea. If you're thinking about adding a third or a fourth medicine for any condition, you should probably first think, should I be swapping that out for one of the others that maybe clearly isn't getting the job done? But absolutely. Anytime you're thinking about adding another medicine, really you should also be thinking about which ones either aren't working or I don't need anymore, and trying to take one away while you're adding one on top of that.
It's a question about antibiotics that occasionally are required by the dental association, etc. But if you've had, let's say, hip surgery, you have a 2 years of waiting period. You have to take quite a big dose of antibiotics. Is this really necessary?
So the question is about taking antibiotics prior to certain surgeries, and are these things necessary? So I can't speak to the recommendations of particular surgical societies around specific procedures. Often these are recommendations made for good reasons based on... So sometimes, and that's true, sometimes the risks that specialists try to avoid by recommending medicines and certain procedures may be pretty low. But again, I can't speak to any particular medicine that's recommended by a surgical society, especially since I'm not expert in that. But in general, it's always a good question to ask exactly what you just said to me. Why? So the guideline says I'm supposed to take this before my surgery. Why is that? What are we trying to avoid? And how dangerous is it really? And then how do I weigh that against potential risks of taking the medicine? Those are great questions to ask that your doctor will actually hate to hear. But they're great questions to ask. In the interest of time, why don't we hold the rest of the questions until the end so we can make sure we get through all of our points. And now I'll turn it back over to Kirby to talk about the next principle about side effects.
Thanks, John. So these are all great questions and comments. And before I move on, I just want to comment on three questions that I heard and emphasize John's point. So he's giving you the example of the Goldilocks principle and the U-shaped curves. He uses the example of blood pressure, but this also happens for many other diseases and conditions. Okay, so it's not just blood pressure that you get this U-shaped curve. Second, the comment about being in the hospital and what about risks there and talking with doctors. There are tons of studies showing that the highest risk for an adverse drug event and a medication problem is when you leave the hospital and you go home, okay? So the biggest thing you can do there, like John said, is get that medication list, make sure you know exactly what medications you should be taking and doing when you go home, and make sure that you know what to do with these medications in the hospital and how do they differ with your medications at home. This is a process called medication reconciliation. It's an accreditation requirement by hospitals. It's a big patient safety issue. This gets to your point about why aren't these doctors talking and why doesn't everyone know what everything's going on. We told you that the system has weaknesses and cracks in it. And so what we want you to do is until we can fix the system, you have to be proactive. You have to help the communication be accurate. And we're going to talk about ways to help you do that. Okay, so again, with the notion that medications can save lives, but they can also cause a lot of harm, we're not just raising red flags without real data. Here's some real data to show you that of a survey of emergency departments in the United States, which ages come into the emergency department because of a medication problem. And you can see here, this side of the figure, the graph, is the very young. And they come in with a decent number of medication adverse drug events. But then here's some teenagers, here's some young adults, here's some middle-aged adults. And then starting at 65, it starts to rise. So now the number of emergency department visits for medication problems starts to go up at 65. Then you can see here at 75, 80, 85, greater than 90 years of age, they come in with lots of adverse drug events. And these often can be prevented. And this is why we are here speaking to you today, and we're very glad that you have come today. And so you're going to ask, why is it that medication side effects and adverse drug reactions are so much more severe in older adults? Okay. Well, there's a lot of changes going on in our bodies as we age. Okay. Unfortunately, our kidneys don't work as well as they used to. Our liver doesn't work as well as it used to. The kidneys are the organs that remove drugs from the body. The liver is the main organ that breaks down drugs in the body. And so if you're not breaking them down and you're not removing them from the body as much, then they tend to build up at higher levels, and they can cause toxic side effects. So that's why it's important to get the dose right. Or maybe you shouldn't be on that drug if it's toxic to the kidneys. This is a little bit more challenging of a concept, but in general, as we age, we lose muscle mass, and we have less water in our body, and we tend to have more fat in our body. And drugs like to distribute in water compartments and fat compartments. And so if you have more fat, then a drug that likes to be in the fat is going to stick in the body longer. And it's called having a longer half-life. And so that can accumulate and cause toxic side effects. Drugs that like to be in the water compartment, think about it. If I have a glass half full of water and I pour in 10 drops, that's going to be more concentrated than if I pour in 10 drops in a glass that's full of water. And so now these drugs have more concentrated effects, and they can cause side effects from that. Again, that's why anytime you're started on a new medication, they should start low and slowly go up so we can avoid these types of effects. We already talked about the more medications someone takes, the higher risk for interactions on an exponential factor. And that some of these side effects also lead to the physiology of your body. So as we age, we usually have less stamina. We usually have less what we call resilience to handle toxic injury or insults. So the drugs can just be that more damaging. We can also be more sensitive to drug effects. This is particularly those drugs that affect your brain. So if it causes drowsiness or dizziness, in someone. An older adult can become really drowsy, really dizzy, and maybe fall or become confused. Okay? This is a term called a pharmacodynamic effect. So older adults are more fragile, but in general, to me, they're more special. And older adults need to be cared for more closely, and drugs need to be fine-tuned. It's that they need just to be just about right. Drug therapy has to be fine-tuned in older adults. And this is a classic example of how older adults are more susceptible to the side effects of drugs. So as you're younger, a younger adult, someone who's in their 30s or 40s, this range of okay is fairly wide. So they might be able to take drugs, and the effects of the drugs have this wide range, but their body can handle it. And unfortunately, as we age, you can see that the physiological changes that our bodies go through, we can tolerate less of the fluctuations of the drugs and their effects. So this is that fine tune. We need to be much more fine tuned as far as the drugs that we give to older adults. And here's a classic example. We like to talk a lot about falls because falls are actually what we call a geriatric syndrome. They can be caused by lots of things just besides medications. But medications contribute a lot to falls. And for example, and we don't have an arrow here to the brain, but as I mentioned before, that medications that might cause drowsiness or sedation or dizziness can lead to a fall. As we age, our our arteries and our veins don't expand and contract as well. And so we can't always handle changes with medications that affect our blood pressure. In fact, oftentimes it leads to we're more suspect to having lower blood pressure in a fall. Our heart rate can't always compensate for a low blood pressure by speeding up and pumping harder, especially if we have heart failure. Our kidneys might not be working so well to clear the medication, and so the medication is having more of an effect. It's lowering your blood pressure too much than a typical dose would in a younger adult. Our muscles are reduced, so they might not be as strong to help us balance if we do have start to fall. And then also we have vascular pooling effects. So sometimes the vasculature in your body, usually when you have low blood pressure, it tends to constrict more and say, okay, hey, my blood pressure's low, I need to constrict more to get my blood pressure back up. But sometimes that doesn't always happen, and so now you're still at risk for low blood pressure. So you can see that it's not just in one area. It's all parts of our body that lead us to these risks. And so that's why the medications need to be carefully titrated and carefully selected. Going back to symptoms and side effects, how do you know if a medication is causing a side effect or is it a new medical condition? Oftentimes we don't know, but the prudent thing to do is to assume that a medication, a new medical condition or a new symptom that you're experiencing is a medication side effect. The reason being is that if we jump to it thinking that it's a new medical condition, what's likely to happen? That's right. And we don't want to just keep adding on more and more medications. So this is a very important point. Think that any new condition or symptom that you're having could be a medication side effect. Here's a classic example of the prescribing cascade and what it looks like where things go awry. So someone could be prescribed a medication called amlodipine because their blood pressure is high. One of the side effects of amlodipine is leg swelling. So now they, at their next doctor's visit, they have leg swelling, and they think that they're having edema in their legs, and they think that might be due to heart failure. So they prescribe furosemide, which is a diuretic, for heart failure. Then from the furosemide, it's going to make them urinate much more frequently. It's a diuretic. So now they think they have urinary incontinence. So for the urinary incontinence, we have a medication for that. It's called ditropan or oxybutynin. So we prescribe this medication to help with the urinary incontinence. And then the oxybutynin, which has strong anticholinergic properties that we mentioned before, can lead to confusion, memory loss, alter your thinking. And so now they might think they have dementia. And so it kind of looks like this. This cascade that just goes with one medication side effect after another and a new medication being prescribed, when really we should have managed their blood pressure differently and switched out the amlodipine. So this is why it's really important to think that any new condition or symptom could be a side effect of a medication. Any questions on this section?
Sometimes you could have, is this correct that you can have a side effect like your body initially, but then your body kind of gets used to it and the side effect goes away or then gets smaller and then you could just keep going?
That's right. So the question is, can't some side effects from medications occur but then go away after time? And that's very true. So one thing that is important, that when you get a new medication prescribed, you should get counseling on what that medication's for, what kinds of side effects does it cause, how it's going to help you. If you do get a side effect, how do I manage it? Lots of medications cause diarrhea, cause nausea. There can be simple strategies like taking it with food to minimize those side effects. There's a medication called metformin that's very commonly prescribed for diabetes, and that's notorious for giving diarrhea, causing diarrhea, but that usually goes away after a few weeks, and it can be a very, very beneficial therapy. But it's a very good question.
I have one other question on the chart about the side effects with the age groups. There's a dotted line between 2 and 3 all the way across. It must represent something. There you go.
Oh, this. So that dotted line shows where the increased risk starts to, the risk of adverse drug events and emergency department visits goes up. So this is.
What's those bars with the?
Yeah. So this is kind of the average, and you can see that these people here are above average. So they're these age groups are having more problems with. Adverse drug events because they're above the average. This is the average number of adverse drug events, and you can see that these people are higher. These are what we call standard error bars, because anytime you do a population-based study, you want to measure how the standard errors, which relates to the deviation, how people differ from these groups differ. And so that's why you see this. And when you see this bar, since it doesn't cross this dotted line, this shows that these groups are significantly at risk for adverse drug events. So the very young, and then where really it starts at, it trends here, but significantly it's the age group 75, 85, 90. Okay. Very good question. I'll get to you, yes?
One of your earlier slides, you had PPIs listed.
Mm-hmm.
I keep seeing on television these law firms that are going, you know, if you have something or other and you've taken PPIs and I guess omeprazole and I don't know what else is in there. So, and I'm just wondering if those drugs have a great adverse effect or, you know, where these lawyers coming from.
I'll briefly answer that question. But the question is, you know, I see a lot of advertisements on TV for lawyers about people using proton pump inhibitors. And are there risks? Yes, there are risks. They're actually on our list of drugs to be used with caution. They can be very effective drugs used short term, but the long term, there are some side effects and risks. And that's why some people have experienced that. And it's funny, if you watch the TV, you can find out which are the more problematic drugs because there's law firms advertising lawsuits for them. And just, I think the woman had a question in the back.
Thank you. I know that, anesthesia, for example, is one of those issues that can vary wildly, even depending on how much pigment you have in your skin. And I'm wondering how age has an effect when an anesthesiologist is trying to figure out what dosages to give you.
So anesthesiology is those drugs are a little bit more unique. Some people can have adverse reactions to them if they've never been exposed, so they want to get an accurate medication history there. But in general, the same principles apply. They'd want to start at a low dose and slowly titrate up. Those drugs are usually fast-acting, so if something bad happens, they can turn them off to prevent a really bad effect. But in general, the same principles apply. In older adults, we don't metabolize drugs as well. They can accumulate. They can cause toxic side effects because of the receptor level, the sensitivity. And so that's where they need to start out low and go slow. One other last comment I wanted to make about, there's some questions about using multiple medications and the law of diminishing returns. Someone's asking, you know, why is it that they might use three or four different medications to treat my diabetes? And sometimes they do that because the condition or the disease itself has multiple effects in the body, and so they need a drug that might work on your liver. They might need a drug that works on your pancreas. They might need a drug that works on your insulin receptors, so they target different areas of where the disease affects, and that's why they might use multiple drugs.
All right, so now moving on to what can you do? And we've been talking about this all night. We're going to try to collect all the tips in one place for you. What can you do? As you've been doing already all evening, ask the right questions. You guys have been asking fantastic questions. Ask your doctor these questions. Three questions in particular that you should ask your doctor. Why am I taking this? Any time that a medication is offered to you, in almost any circumstance, the first thing that should come to mind is, why should I think about taking this? So why do we take medicines? We take medicines because we have diseases, right? Right? Sort of. Not exactly. We don't take medicines just because we have a label of some disease. We take medicines for specific purposes. We take medicines because the disease we have is causing a risk of something we'd like to avoid. And maybe that's death. Maybe that's a heart attack. Maybe that's a stroke. Something that we want to avoid if possible. That doesn't make us feel better right now, but the whole idea is to avoid feeling really bad in the future. That can be a really good reason to take a medicine. We also take medicines just to feel better, to treat symptoms that we're actually experiencing that are affecting us, that are affecting our quality of life, that are affecting our ability to do things that we want to do. So we don't just take medicines because we have a disease, but we take medicines for specific purposes, to reduce risks or to treat symptoms that we're experiencing. Really, you shouldn't ever feel like, I have this disease, therefore I must take this drug. What's the purpose? To prevent strokes, for example, from treating your high blood pressure. Or in the case of certain medicines for Parkinson's, you're taking a medicine to treat the tremor that's getting in the way of doing the things you want to do with your life. So take drugs for good reasons. But these also interact with what is important to you. All drugs have side effects. Is the benefit that I'm expecting to get, either in reducing a risk of something or in treating a symptom, is that benefit worth the possible side effects? And then how do I weigh this particular medicine in this particular circumstance against all the other medicines I take? How does this rate in terms of what's most important to me? Beware the zombie medication. So someone brought this up about what if you go to the hospital for something, for some illness, and you wind up with a much longer list of medicines when you leave? Many of those are for a very good reason. But often, maybe I'll see someone, after a while, maybe you'll see your doctor again a year from now, and there's this long list of medicines, and some of them, no one knows where it came from. No one knows why it was started. No one knows what it's for. And often, we're not brave enough to stop it, but we should be. Zombie medications are especially common after hospitalizations or after ER visits. Often these are things that were only meant to be taken for a short time, often for a very good reason. But then they just stick around, and no one puts the stake in them. So what are some of these medicines? So very common ones are various kinds of sleep medicines, various sorts of allergy medicines. You know, maybe you'll try something for a week or two, see if it helps your post-nasal drip, but then 3 years later you're on it, and you don't really have allergies. Acid reflux medicines, like the proton pump inhibitors, these are often started in the hospital. They're often started just as you're having some dyspepsia, some heartburn, and try this for a month, see if it works. But then we forget to go back and ask a month later, did it actually work? Or it started in the hospital, and then someone thinks it must have been started for some, I should probably be still taking this a year later. But no, it's a zombie medicine. Pain medicines can be zombie medicines. Often these should only be taken for a short time. Constipation medicines can be zombie medicines. So, you know, all these, some people should be on these for a long time, but it shouldn't be by accident. Kill the zombie medicines. All right, so why am I taking this medicine is one question you should be asking. Is this the right medicine is another one. So to answer, is this the right medicine, first we'll say there are some medicines that are more likely than others to be the wrong medicine. So if it's the wrong medicine, it's probably not the right medicine. How do you know what might be the wrong medicine? The Beers criteria is a great tool. So it's actually a Dr. Beers. This is not sponsored by Anheuser-Busch or anything. It's a Dr. Beers who is a geriatrician. It's a list that's put together by the American Geriatric Society and updated every few years. And it's medicines that are relatively commonly used, but for one reason or another should be used cautiously in older adults. You know, meaning that it's not necessarily that you should never use a medicine that's on the Beers list, but you should only do it thoughtfully. These aren't the sort of medicines that should be a kind of knee-jerk prescription. You should think hard and carefully about them. So what are some of these medicines? Now, I'll bet that some of you take some of these medicines. I do, too. It doesn't mean you should never take them, but that you should be very careful with them and thoughtful. So non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are an example. Digoxin, certain diabetes drugs. Muscle relaxants, which we like to say relax the brain more than the muscles. Certain anxiety drugs. Kirby alluded already to anticholinergic drugs like diphenhydramine and like drugs for bladder because they can cause confusion. Certain antihistamines for the same reason, because they're anticholinergic. Estrogen pills and patches, antipsychotics. Many of these are very useful in the right circumstance, but should only be used with caution in a very thoughtful way. So the American Geriatric Society has put together a website, healthinaging.org, which has some really fantastic information and handouts meant for ordinary people and for doctors about what's on this Beers list, why should some of these medications be used with a very cautious eye, and should you find that you're taking one of them, what should you do? So there are some drugs that are more likely to cause problems than others. A lot of them are on the Beers list. But the other principle I want to tell you guys about, though, is that you know, the reality is that the most dangerous drugs are often the ones that are doing the most good. They're just inherently powerful medicines. So if you actually look at, so as Kirby showed you some data that older adults are more likely to wind up in the emergency room because of a drug side effect or an adverse event. So what are the drugs that actually cause those emergency room visits? Well, most of them, far and away, are caused by warfarin and by insulin. And far down the list, then, there are other drugs that are blood thinners, other drugs used to treat diabetes, so kind of the same theme. And then down here, we get to the drugs in the Beers criteria, which really don't cause that many emergency room visits. Most of them are caused by blood thinners and diabetes medicines. So that is not because these are bad medicines. These are life-saving medicines, but they're very powerful medicines with powerful effects, and the side effect is inherent in how they work. Blood thinners thin your blood. They're meant to stop blood clots. The thing is, when you're bleeding, you want your blood to clot, so you can't avoid the side effect entirely. It's inherent in how the medicine works. Same thing with diabetes medicines. Many of these, they're meant to work by lowering your blood sugar. If they lower your blood sugar too much, that's a problem. But you can't avoid them altogether. If you have diabetes, you need often to lower your blood sugar one way or another. You just don't want to do it too much. So powerful medicines save lives, but powerful medicines, particularly blood thinners, particularly diabetes medicines, carry powerful risks. So what can you do? Know how what you do affects how the medicine works. So warfarin, the blood thinner warfarin, is a classic example of this, where the food that you eat affects how strongly warfarin works. You have to be very careful if you're taking warfarin to eat the same way most of the time, or to watch what you eat carefully. So for each drug that you take, know how what you do affects it in terms of diet, in terms of symptoms you have to watch out for, in terms of when to take it, and things like that. If you're on a drug that can cause a serious life-threatening side effect, know what the warning signs of that are. Know what low blood sugar feels like. Know what to look for in case you might be bleeding from your stomach or from your intestine. Know the warning signs to look for so you catch those serious side effects early. And tell your doctor everything about those medicines. So about how you take it, if you have any trouble taking it. We'll talk more about this later. But everything to do with your experience of taking this medicine, make sure your doctor knows. And never, ever hesitate to ask for help. Ask your doctor, ask your pharmacist, ask your nurse. Always ask for help if you have questions about these powerful medicines. So is this the right medicine? But the other part of that is this the right medicine for me? We're all different. We're all unique individual human beings or with different biology, different physiology, and our bodies have different life experiences, just like our brains do. So is this the right medicine for me? And here's how I think about that as a doctor. So is this the right medicine for the person in front of me? I think of three things. Is this the right medicine in the context of your medical history? Do any of your other medical problems affect that particular medicine? And so, as Kirby talked about, your kidneys, your liver can affect how your body reacts and processes medicines. So is this the right medicine for you with your chronic illnesses, your medical history? Is this the right medicine in the context of all the other medicines you take? So many medicines interact with each other. For example, will this interact with my warfarin? Again, warfarin is one of the classics. Many medicines affect how well warfarin works. You have to be very careful with each medicine you add. How will this work with, since we talked about, we often wind up on more than one medicine for the same disease. How will this affect the other medicine you take for that same disease? Sometimes two medicines can work in different ways. That's helpful. Sometimes they can actually work at odds with each other, even in the same disease. So that's all about your body and your medical conditions, but also what about your priorities? And often there's no right answer here. It really is up to you and what's important to you in your life. So how do you weigh the benefit that you're trying to get versus the possible risks? Side effects are common. If you get common side effects, how would that affect your daily life? For some people, being a little dizzy from time to time, maybe they can cope with that by being, really careful about how they get up, by maybe, doing the tightrope anymore. If you're a tennis player, though, if like playing tennis is your thing, you probably don't want to suddenly get dizzy in the middle of a tennis match, not only because it would affect your game, but because you might fall and break something in the middle of your tennis match. So how would the common side effects affect you? And finally, as I was saying, how does this rank among all the medicines I take? The benefit I'm trying to get from this medicine, is that the most important thing? Or is this going to be like the 10th or 12th most important thing of all the medicines I take? How do I rank it among all the others? If you're thinking about starting a new medicine and you'd probably rank it at the very bottom in terms of how important that benefit is to you, well, then maybe you should think long and hard before adding it to the list. On the other hand, if it's going to be the most important thing that you're taking, if it's going to help prevent strokes and that's the most important thing to you, then go ahead. Yeah, put it at the top of the list. And maybe you should reconsider the ones that are now at the bottom of the list. And maybe you can stop one or two of those. So for every new medicine, and at least once a year for all of your medicines, you should be talking to your doctor and your pharmacist about why am I taking this? Do I still need it? Is it a zombie? And is it still the best choice and the best choice for me? So we'll pause there and again take some questions before we move on to the last part. Go ahead.
The question I have is about thinking over time. It felt like a lot of the picture of the cocktail medications we're talking about are essentially static, that they're going to affect the person the same after a month as it will, say, after 10 years. But we know that's not true. For many classes of medications, steroids, for example, that can only be taken for a few months because they have cumulative side effects. So I was hoping you could address the issue of medications that have cumulative side effects and don't act the same way over time.
Yeah, fantastic question. So about short-term versus long-term use of medications that have serious side effects. And how do we think about medications that maybe are relatively safe over a short time but become progressively more dangerous the longer you take them? And there are many examples of those. You mentioned steroids, which are one of them. Steroids can be great medicines for short-term for specific problems. But if you're on steroids for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, they can really cause problems. So that's an example of you want to be very thoughtful about when a short-term medicine turns into a long-term medicine. Often that's not really done on purpose, but it winds up being done by default. Maybe you didn't mean to take it for a long time, but whatever the problem is that you're treating, it just isn't getting better fast enough, so you stay on it. Whatever the reason, it's important to take a time out every once in a while. Once a year is probably a good measure, and reassess, why am I on this? Do I really still need to be on this? Because I don't want to be on this for 10 years if the risks and benefits aren't going to balance out the way I like. That's a great question. And
I guess I'm wondering if you are able to address long-term narcotics abusers, and as they age, how you are able to deal with that.
So actually, one other point I should make on the last question I just remembered is don't forget, as Kirby talked about, your body changes over time. So a medicine that wasn't having side effects for you 10 years ago, 20 years ago, even if the medicine's not changing, remember your body is. And so medicines can affect you differently as you get older, even if you've been taking it for most of your life. And then your question is about chronic opiate users.
Let's say, you're an addict. Mm-hmm. And I come to you, I'll put this on me, let's pretend, and I go to you and I say, can you help me out? I need some help with my health care, and I'm willing to tell you all about my long-term narcotics abuse. Are you finding more of this? And if so, how are you dealing with it?
So a question about folks who might be long-term opiate users or abusers, and as they get older, whether or not they're still taking opiates. So I guess the first point I'd say is, again, your body changes out from under you as you get older. So the way that medicines or drugs affect you will change as you get older. And whatever seemed safe and reasonable to you 20 or 30 years ago may not be anymore. The other part of that, though, is that so in someone who's used opiates for a long time specifically, that will affect the way your body responds to different medicines because it's changed your body. That's what I sort of meant when I said your body's lifelong experience. Everything that you put in your body has an effect on your cells and your biochemistry, and it will over time affect how your body responds to other things. So someone who's taken opiates for a long time, they will respond, even if they stop in the future, it'll change the way their body responds to opiates later on. And that's something that needs to be thought about when you're thinking about prescribing any medicine for someone who's been on a drug for a long time like that. Hope that helps.
Can you expand your comments on the use of estrogen pills, not in menopausal women, but in postmenopausal women, for use long-term?
Yeah, so the question is about, you caught this on the bottom of the list of some of the medicines to be cautious with. There's estrogen pills and patches. I would encourage you to head over to the Health and Aging website and check out the information they have about these medicines. There's actually as much information as you could possibly want at increasing levels of detail as you wish to dive in about why some of these things are on the list of things to be cautious about. For estrogen, it's largely because randomized trials of estrogen in postmenopausal women showed an increased risk of cardiovascular events. And so unless there's a good reason for it, the long-term use of estrogen in postmenopausal women is probably not a good idea and can be harmful to health. Unless there's a good reason for it. And this is another great example of many women may find a benefit from these over the short term as they're perimenopausal, and that's fine. The risk over a short term is much less than the risk over 20 or 30 years. Or I'll point you to one of the other slides I had. Let's see, where was this? Is this the right medicine for me? Oh, sorry, I have to go back. What are your priorities? Why do we take medicines in the first place? We take medicines to avoid risks, but we also take medicines to treat symptoms, to treat things that are interfering with our lives, because the whole point of medical care is to help us live better, healthier, longer lives, to do what we want to do. So if you have a medicine that's treating a symptom that's really affecting your life, you might be willing to accept that there may be some risk of other things because this is more important to you than the potential side effect. And that's perfectly reasonable, but something that you should make an informed choice about, especially for things that are on this beers list. So I won't repeat that question because I don't want to relay your personal medical information. But certainly a nice example of just being aware of what medicines do and making informed choices about what you're trying to accomplish and the risks of it. And I'll hold the questions just so we can make sure to get in the last few points from Kirby before we finish up. And then we'll both be sticking around afterwards, and you're welcome to come up to ask other questions too.
Yeah, we'll definitely stick around for a while after the session to answer any questions that you might have. So the very last few slides are just to emphasize what can you do to avoid these pitfalls and to prevent an adverse drug event and to optimize the use of your medications. And we've mentioned this before, it's really important to have that medication list to make sure it's up to date and accurate and to share that with all of your doctors. This is really allows people to make informed decisions, including yourself, and to make sure that we can prescribe the right medications at the right doses. I can't emphasize this enough. If you want to use a computer on Word, Excel, a word processor, that's really helpful. There's now apps that you can get from the iTunes Store, Google Play, on your phone. But any way you want to do it, a medication list is very, very valuable. And then really talk to your doctors. Talk to your pharmacists. Take the time to ask questions and get answers to your questions, okay? Because that's the only way you're going to be able to make an informed decision, and also to let them know, oh, my gosh, that is a significant side effect. We should stop that drug. If you're not telling them, then they won't know. Please tell them about any problems that you have. So are you having difficulty paying for your medications? A lot of the older adults I work with, their insurance doesn't cover certain medications or the medications are really expensive, which if they were just taking a few medications, they could maybe deal with. But because they're taking 15 or 20 medications, their copays end up to be in the $300, $400, $500. So it can be very, very expensive. And there are ways to reduce your drug costs. There's drug cost savings programs, there's discount drugs, there's coupons, there's alternative drugs. So a lot of times the brand can be very expensive, but generics can be cheaper and just as effective. Taking your medications can be very challenging, so we often recommend folks use a pill box because that can be very helpful in organizing your medications. It also helps with forgetfulness. Because if you've taken it, then it's no longer in the little bin in the box. Some pharmacies will actually package medications in a pill box for you and deliver it. Sometimes they don't use a pill box, but they use a bubble pack or a blister pack that's easy for you to pop out, and they'll deliver it to your home. So think of those types of services to take advantage of. Let us know about those side effects and what your priorities are. So some side effects can be short-term and be minimized by taking with food or simple other strategies. Some side effects are very problematic where we either need to change the dose or stop the drug completely. Okay. And then lastly, we want to finish up in that, you know, there are good medicines out there that can save lives. There are bad medicines out there that can cause death and worsen your quality of life. You don't want to over-treat, you don't want to under-treat. So we're getting back into that kind of fine-tuning of medications. Okay. And then remember, I think we talked about this already, but you know, there's lots of things that you can do that John and I have emphasized over and over. And so we really want you to be proactive and to be asking questions and communicating with your doctors and your pharmacists and any other healthcare provider. Okay. And really a take-home message is that less is often more. Too much we see older adults just taking way too many medications that are not needed, that they could probably use other interventions and that don't require medication.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.